Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
America has an important strategic interest in preventing Gaddafi from overrunning those who oppose him. A massacre would have driven thousands of additional refugees across Libya's borders, putting enormous strains on the peaceful yet fragile transitions in Egypt and Tunisia. The democratic impulses that are dawning across the region would be eclipsed by the darkest form of dictatorship, as repressive leaders concluded that violence is the best strategy to cling to power.
President Obama looking not just at Libya, but to its right and left as he formulates U.S. policy. My first guest this hour is looking at the Middle East from a unique vantage point. Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, is a consultant to investors on political risk around the world. He wrote in the Financial Times recently about the much tougher choice than Libya that President Obama is starting to be faced with, whether to favor democracy or our reliable oil sellers in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, for example, have now sent troops to Bahrain, which is one of the countries shooting at protesters. On Meet the Press Sunday, David Gregory asked Defense Secretary Robert Gates if the U.S.-Saudi relationship has ruptured.
We have a very strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. I think that the Saudis see all of this turbulence in the region with some disquiet. They're very concerned about Iran. They believe that Iran will be able to take advantage of the situation in various of these countries, and those are their concerns. And we share some of those concerns. But I think it's a great exaggeration to say this relationship's ruptured. I intend to visit the region in the near term and hope and intend to see the king. So I think we have a very strong relationship. We have a very strong military-to-military relationship. As you know, the Saudis just made one of the largest purchases of American weapons in their history. So I think it's overdrawn. Do we have some differences of view? Absolutely. But that's friends happen. That happens between friends all the time.
Defense Secretary Gates on Meet the Press on Sunday. Let's talk about it with Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group and author of books including The J-Curve and The End of the Free Market. And we'll talk about his idea of a G-Zero world as well. Hi, Ian. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Just to make sure we're all at the same starting point, why does Saudi Arabia matter so much to the United States?
Well, I think there are two reasons. The historical, of course, is that they're the largest oil producer in the world, and they also are the one producer out there with significant additional capacity, so that when there are problems, let's say with Libyan oil offline, the Saudis can actually make that up in a way that no other country can. They're also important because they're increasingly the most important political actor, security actor, in the broader Gulf region, a part of the world that we're seeing a lot of restiveness on the part of local populations.
And the relationship over the years has been, we will look the other way on your lack of democracy, repression of women, coddling of Islamist radicals, as long as you sell us cheap oil. Does Washington have to make a stark choice, to use the term in your FTP, stark choice between democracy and oil, or is that overstating it?
Oh, no, I don't think we have to make a stark choice. I think we can avoid making the choice. But if we avoid making the choice, the relationship between U.S. and Saudi Arabia will deteriorate, right? I mean, we're hedging. Obama doesn't want to make any choices on foreign policy. He really is a much more of a domestic-oriented president in terms of his policy. We're 2 years into the Obama administration. The president doesn't have a doctrine on foreign policy. It's probably the first time we've seen that since Ford.
You don't think he expressed a doctrine in his speech the other night?
I think he moved a little bit towards that, but I think really what if there is an Obama worldview, it is that the United States does not want to be taking a leadership role out in front. They want to stay on the wing side. They want to hedge. I think that's really what American foreign policy in the region is all about. There are just bigger priorities that he's going to be judged on in 2012, and he is keenly aware of that.
And I don't know if you heard the the lead story on NPR News at the top of this hour, or if you knew that this was coming anyway, but apparently the president is going to announce today a 10-year plan to reduce our foreign oil dependence by one-third. It's as if he knew that we were coming on to talk about Saudi Arabia and the relationship with the United States. Have you seen any details? Do you think this is for real?
What I've seen only in the course of the last sort of hour implies that there's not much new in terms of policy statements there. It's kind of like, you know, headline around budget deficit reduction, and then when you actually see, you know, what's out there and what's doable politically, it's a little bit more sizzle than steak. But to get back to the question that you asked, you know, sort of right at the outset, U.S.-Saudi relations are they're deeply personalized. The Saudis don't really have a functional bureaucracy. It's all about the folks in the family that run that government. Obama did not come into the presidency with those relationships. Neither did his key policy advisors in the White House. To the extent that there's a group in the United States that truly detests Obama, it's probably U.S. oil CEOs, the big multinationals. Those are the guys that are closest to the Saudis and talk with them on a regular basis. Combine that with the fact that Obama has been fairly consistent in trying to say that, you know, we really want to see support for political and economic reform in countries like Bahrain, which are absolutely no-go zones. From the Saudi perspective, they see this as a sectarian conflict. As Gates said, it supports the Iranians. They want to ensure that King Khalifa stays in. If they need to use force to ensure that outcome, they absolutely will. I would say that the U.S.-Saudi relationship is probably, of all of the countries in the world, a lot of people are very well disposed to Obama. I would say that that's probably the single relationship that has deteriorated the most dramatically among major countries since Obama's become president.
So what's at stake in this choice? If the U.S. speaks too forcefully, for example, on behalf of the democracy movement in Bahrain, will the Saudi king stop selling us oil or raise the price to pressure us or what?
No. First, I don't think the Saudis will pay much attention. I think that they're going to continue to ignore American entreaties on the way they should be treating Bahrain, and that will make the Americans look less effective in this part of the world. So, you know, when you say that you have to do X, Y, or Z or else, I mean, let's face it, Gaddafi has to go. So if in 6 months Gaddafi's still there, the U.S. isn't going to look as useful. Its influence will, its political capital will deteriorate in the region. If the Americans are telling the Saudis, we have to see a reform process in Bahrain, and instead it's force that allows King Khalifa to stay in place, then the Americans don't look as effective. So American influence in the region is at stake here. And also, I think with the United States increasingly looking in the Gulf as a taker and not a maker of foreign policy, that you'll see a more cohesive Gulf Cooperation Council with the Saudis out in front. They're going to still sell oil, and they're going to still sell oil to us, even though we don't get much oil from the Saudis. Mostly the Europeans and the Chinese get oil from the Saudis. But they also will be more, they'll be quicker to denominate that oil, not in dollars, but in a basket of currencies and move away. And I think they'll be quicker to move towards a Gulf currency, a common currency, which is going to undermine the role of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And that does have long-term economic implications for rank-and-file Americans.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group and author of books including The J-Curve and The End of Free Market, the Free Market, and articles including his Financial Times piece the other day, Washington's Stark Choice, Democracy or Riyadh. Riyadh, of course, the capital of Saudi Arabia. You can take phone calls for Ian Bremmer, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. He calculates political risk for investors. That's the main thing that the Eurasia Group does. So do you see Saudi Arabia as likely to go the way of Egypt or Bahrain or Libya? They're all very different. Do you see any form of a serious anti-king movement taking shape in that country, or is that too stable?
There is an anti-king movement in Saudi Arabia. It is largely among the Shia in the eastern province. And when they started demonstrating and demanding regime change a few weeks ago, that led the majority Sunni to be much less willing to take part in this day of rage that was put together the next day in Riyadh. And so I think that Saudi Arabia is a strikingly stable place in terms of actual regime entrenchment. And King Abdullah is 87 years old, speculated. It's not quite an official figure. Mm-hmm. And though he looks great, he could go tomorrow. If he did, the government's not going anywhere. The kingdom's not going anywhere. But you would end up with another ruler who's much more conservative and much less willing to engage in the kind of reforms, long-term incremental reform, that have really marked the Abdullah leadership. And so my concern is not about Saudi Arabia in the next year or 2 years or 5 years. My concern is that in a country where, you know, sort of women have been gradually getting more opportunities and better education, and the Saudi youth have been pushed towards, you know, sort of taking a more responsible role and having, you know, sort of actually taking jobs, even if they're working class jobs, it's hard to do in a very conservative Saudi society, that reform process will grind to a halt once Abdullah is gone. And when you think it 10 years out or 20 years out, you then ask yourself questions of how sustainable Saudi Arabia really is. I mean, the world's big questions for long-term sustainability of authoritarian regimes are Russia, they're China, and they're Saudi Arabia. None of those three countries face near-term threats, but all three are long-term going to seriously wrestle with what to do with governments that are very, very reluctant to engage in structural political reform.
Joel in Union, you're on WNYC. Hey, Joel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, it's wonderful to hear Mr. Bremer's breadth of knowledge, but I must question him on the notion of America's leadership role in the Middle East, that Obama, in his caution, may be compromising this leadership role. Our leadership role has gotten us into two wars against enemies, real or imaginary, enormously costly, and the people of this region know this very, very well. They mistrust us. I happen to support Obama in his actions, collective action against Gaddafi. And my leftist friends think I'm crazy, but I think he may have gotten it right this time. But I really question the notion of our leadership role as a positive thing.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that our leadership role is a positive thing. I was suggesting it's a thing.
Okay.
And that leadership role can erode and probably will and clearly is, from my perspective. You know, this is, I'm not very interested in sort of taking a normative position on saying the U.S. is good, the U.S. is bad. We're trying to analyze kind of what's going on here. And whether or not you like what Obama's doing in Libya, what's pretty clear is that if the Arab League, an organization that we have paid exactly zero attention to over the course of decades, if they hadn't stood up and said, we want this no-fly zone, and if Sarkozy, if the French hadn't said, we want to do this, the U.S. would not be engaged. That's a very different kind of U.S. and kind of U.S. role than the one that we've seen over the course of the past decade. Some will like that, some will dislike that, but it will have implications. It'll have implications for the dollar, it'll have implications for oil, it'll have implications for the orientation of America's historic allies in the region. And all of those things are things we should be paying attention to, whether or not we think it's good.
Thank you for your call, Joel. We appreciate it. Did Saudi Arabia join the rest of the Arab League in supporting the intervention, even calling for the intervention in Libya? Do you know?
Without any question, they did. And, you know, one of the interesting things about Libya is that Gaddafi has no friends. I mean, just none. He is the Kim Jong-il of the Middle East. The Saudis believed that that Gaddafi tried to assassinate Abdullah when he was crown prince. The Iranians hate him for efforts he's taken and fingerprints that Gaddafi and his colleagues have in key Lebanese and Iranian leadership figures historically. No one, and he's an oil producer. Nobody wanted to see this guy actually stay in power. So, I mean, this was the low bar for getting support from the Arab world, and such support was there.
But I still wonder, why would the king encourage the democracy movement by supporting intervention in Libya to prop it up. You heard the first clip we played of President Obama. He sees the war in Libya as enabling protesters throughout the region. He didn't say except Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, clearly the fact that the Saudis wanted Gaddafi to go has nothing to do with the Saudis wanting Obama to enable democracy across the region. This was very much a realpolitik kind of demand. The Saudis would be very happy, and as we've seen from WikiLeaks, from interventions that would remove some of the Iranians from power as well. I mean, you know, everyone's capable of talking their book here, and the Saudis' book in the region is pretty thick.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, which consults investors on political risks around the world. He's author of books including The J-Curve and The End of the Free Market. Had an op-ed in the Financial Times about Saudi Arabia. And Madeline on Long Island. You're on WNYC. Hello, Madeline.
Hello. I love your show. And I'm driving along and listening and saying all these years we've been in bed with the Saudis, and yet I'm hearing the facts that it's, you know, obviously it's all been about the price of oil, but the fact that we're getting so little oil from them, why are we making these concessions and these allowances when, A, we're not even getting that much oil from them, and, B, look at the price of fuel already. If we cozied up, we're getting nothing. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, I mean, Tom Friedman would argue that higher oil prices would be great because it would actually force the United States to take longer-term sustainable policies on energy, and there are a lot of people on the environmental side that feel that way. We don't need to be getting oil directly from Saudi for Saudi oil to be important for us. You know, the world markets may have inefficiencies, but it is basically one big bathtub. There's only so much oil out there, and there's only so much demand out there. And so when the Saudis decide or don't make oil available, let's say, to the Europeans, then those prices are going to go up, and they're going to go up eventually for absolutely everybody. We'll feel it. You know, but let's be clear, the Saudis are going to continue to produce oil. They're going to do it whether or not we want them to, because it's utterly in their interest to do so. And if the Libyan oil stays off for a long time and demand keeps going up, the Saudis will produce some of their present spare capacity. So I don't think we have to worry that much about Saudi leverage directly on oil, but they are a very big economy in the region, and as I suggested, if the Saudis are going to move in a more coordinated direction away from the U.S. dollar and away from the U.S. economy and maybe even away from U.S. arms over the long term and towards other countries, and certainly the Chinese, who are trying to buy an awful lot of Saudi oil, would love to sell a lot of arms to Saudi Arabia, all of that will have an effect on American national interests. Not only in the region, but also American taxpayers. So it's more complicated than just looking at sort of Saudi oil isn't going to us, so why should we care?
You know, and Madeline, thank you for your call. As we sit here and do the show from 10 to 12 Eastern time every day, it seems like about every 2 minutes there's something from the Middle East that comes over the urgent wire on the Associated Press. So just since we've been doing this conversation, we have this, for example, from Damascus. Residents say Syrian troops have opened fire during a protest in the port city of Latakia. And we have this from Egypt, like a minute ago. Egypt's official news agency says Egypt's military has decided to hold presidential elections by November at the latest. And, of course, we've been talking about Saudi Arabia and Libya and Bahrain. With all of this going on, and considering who your clients are, is this good or bad for the investment community?
No, it's bad for the investment community, but it's also not structural. You know, the way that the media frequently has been portraying, especially in the United States, all of this is the Arab Spring, dominoes are falling, all of these countries are going to be in flames. The countries that are most unstable in this part of the world right now are really the countries that aren't doing as well economically. That does matter less for the international investment community. The big oil producers, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Kuwaitis, the Emiratis, these are not the countries that are in significant trouble. And, I mean, frankly, the Libyan government, if there hadn't been international intervention, is an oil producer, they'd be consolidated right now with horrifying human rights implications on the ground and devastation. But nonetheless, it was that point. I think what's interesting about the Middle East over the course of the last few months is it's not just been Arab Spring. It's first there was a wave of democratization. Then there was a wave of authoritarian states consolidating and learning, and some of that was repression, and some of that was co-optation and buying off would-be opposition. And now you have the most dynamic and in some ways the most destabilizing piece, which is the internationalization. You have foreigners involved directly in the Libyan conflict with very unknown outcome. You have the Saudis directly with their troops in Bahrain and others from the Gulf as well. You have Israel and Palestine with the Gaza fight flaring up again. So it's not the rise of the Arab nations right now that's driving most of the risk for the investment community. It's actually the rise of geopolitics on this sort of great chessboard that we call the Middle East.
Last thing, your book, The J-Curve, creates an index, a graph on a J-curve that charts openness and stability. And so, for example, the U.S. is both very open and very stable. China is very closed and very stable. And you're right that as countries move from more closed to more open, like some of these Middle Eastern countries right now, they have to go through instability. But the new thinking this year is that things like U.S. foreign policy and maybe the J-curve are flawed because dictatorships turn out to be the least stable, not the most stable, political systems in the modern world. Do you accept that?
No, I don't accept it at all. I think that consolidated authoritarian regimes can be quite stable as long as they have the money to keep themselves in power. When you have a consolidated authoritarian regime that suddenly faces a massive economic shock, that entire J-curve shifts downward. I don't think that Kim Jong-il in North Korea is very stable. I think a shock to that regime could blow it up in a very serious way, very different from Saudi Arabia. What we've seen this year is that the last 2+ years after a financial crisis have had significant implications on economies throughout North Africa and the Levant, and it's created a lot of stresses on countries across that region, on governments across that region that now have to ask themselves, are they going to reform or not? You saw that Assad in Syria has just in the last 5 minutes opened fire on some of his people. Assad knows very well that if he actually engages in broad political reform across Syria, given the economic situation of that country right now, that's probably going to hasten his demise. So he's in trouble, and he knows it. But for someone like Assad, the easiest thing for him to do, if he can get away with it, is cracking down. That's what Gaddafi understood, and the international community intervened. If the international community doesn't intervene on Bashar Assad, I suspect next time you and I are talking on your show, he's still going to be in power.
Fascinating. And more on that. Residents say Syrian troops have opened fire during a protest in the port city of Latakia. And to Ian's point, the protest came shortly after President Assad made his first speech since the unrest began nearly 2 weeks ago. He blamed conspirators for the extraordinary wave of dissent against his authoritarian rule, but he failed to lift the country's despised emergency law or offer any concessions. Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group and author of books including The J-Curve and The End of the Free Market. Thank you very, very much.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will take calls from Harlem about how you think President Obama is doing after he visited the neighborhood last night. In fact, you can start calling us now, but only from Harlem. How's Obama doing as president, in your opinion? And did you go out to try to get a glimpse last night? 212-433-WNYC, the informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific presidential approval poll only for listeners in Harlem. 212-433-9692.